Welcome to International Women's Day special programming on KPFA Radio. I am Lisa Detmer, and I am your host for this hour. What is International Women's Day? In this hour, we will learn about the radical socialist history of International Women's Day with two American scholars, Eileen Boris and Premila Nadasen. And while IWD doesn't generate mass marches anymore in the U.S., Women's Day is still an important day for protest and celebration in many places around the world. Today we will talk to some women activists in South Africa, the Philippines, and Mexico, who will talk about the importance of Women's Day marches against gender violence and patriarchy in their countries. So stay tuned. For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
I'm Eileen Boris, and I hold the Hull Professorship in Feminist Studies and Women and Social Justice at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I'm also affiliated with the Departments of History, Black Studies, and Global Studies. And my expertise, I suppose, is on women's labors in the home and other workplaces. So International Women's Day is one of those holiday, non-holidays, that is actually observed in some places in Europe, was observed in China for a time, but it was revitalized by the women's liberation movement in the late 1960s and 1970s. The origins of Women's Day, as it was called in some circles, comes out of the socialist movement and the international feminist movement of the period before World War I. In 1908, beginning in that period, there were great uprisings of women workers arguing for better conditions and better pay. And socialist women in Europe and the United States strengthened their commitment in those years through their women's committees and by meeting together. Both in the United States and Europe, some socialists had taken a back seat to suffragism because they viewed women's political rights as subordinate to economic advancement of the working class. But women in the Second International won the support of their male comrades for suffrage campaigns before World War I. And there began to be a number of mass meetings of women led by suffrage groups. It's really when we look at 1909 to 1911-12 that we see these meetings. The Socialist Party of the US had the first International Women's Day on the 28th of February of 1909. Later, we begin to see with the Second International Working Women's Conferences that in 1911, on the 40th anniversary of the Paris Commune, the first International Women's Day took place in Europe. So in this period, right before World War I, the international socialist women's movement began to celebrate women workers and calling for women's rights, including political rights. One event that really is closely associated with International Women's Day, of course, is in 1917. On the last Sunday of February, Russian women began a strike for bread and peace in response to the death of 2 million Russian soldiers in the war. And that date of with the women's strike of Sunday, the 23rd of February, this often is seen, which would be 8th of March on our calendar, as the event that International Women's Day after the revolution in Russia became celebrated then. And really in the period of the 20s up through the 60s, International Women's Day was associated as a communist holiday, no longer just a socialist holiday in many places, including Spain during the Civil War there of the 30s. But it was revived in the United States around 1967 by so-called Red Diaper Babies among women's liberation groups. And I can remember in the mid 70s, attending a Chicago Women's Liberation meeting for International Women's Day, where we had films about strikes in France and about women's activism against apartheid in South Africa. And today, particularly after the 1975 International Women's Year and the decade, it has been celebrated by international women's groups as well as feminist groups around the world.
As we come marching, marching, unnumbered women dead, go crying through our singing, their ancient strife for bread. Small love to love and beauty, their trudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The
So when we consider women's mass demonstrations at this moment, many of them were associated with the events around 2016 and the aftermath of that election, when the first time a woman was nominated for president and was defeated by a grab 'em by the pussy, misogynist and totally corrupt politician, man, Donald Trump. And the Women's March certainly was a protest against the misogyny, against and really for women's rights, but against the kind of exposés of sexual harassment and of inequality that women were experiencing. But we understand women today in a very intersectional way. We don't understand women just meaning white women or white middle-class women, and neither did the socialist women of the past. But today, race and the differentiations from racial capitalism and settler colonialism is very much in our minds. The mass movements of today are less mass perhaps than in the past in this country, but we see International Women's Day around the world. Particularly today, we're beginning to have a shift. And the shift is of women organizing for what we might call work issues, with work defined not only as employment, but as the crisis of COVID has shown, not only are women the essential workers who go out to work, but the crisis has really hit predominantly cisgendered women, but all people who are care workers for their own households and communities. And so these workplace issues have come to the forefront. Again, not only because women still earn, that is those classified as women, less than those classified as men, but because the pandemic has exposed gendered and racialized inequalities, inequalities that relate to citizenship as well, and which sector of the economy, whether you can go out to work or work remotely, or whether you go into people's homes as domestic and care workers do, but are losing your job because people are fearful during the pandemic. So we're at a moment that International Women's Day can go back to its roots with the mobilization of farmworking women, of household and care workers, the domestic movement here and worldwide, who've been particularly hurt by the pandemic, as well as women who are working in offices, in white collar, as the service sector, which is predominantly so-called female-oriented sector, that is a workforce that the closing down of restaurants has been really hurt, and retail. So this is a moment when the issues of the first International Women's Days have come back in this broader concern of rewarding the work that is done in the home and other workplaces for social justice.
Go marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women means the rising of us all. No more the drudge and idler, tend that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses.
My name is Carmelin Addison. I teach at Barnard College. So International Women's Day is not celebrated in the U.S. to the same extent that it's celebrated in other parts of the world. It has a very, obviously, a strong sort of tradition in Europe especially. And it's not recognized as a national holiday here in the U.S., of course. And part of the reason for that has to do with the radical origins of International Women's Day. So even though it really started here in the United States, as you say, by Eastern European women workers, mostly in the garment industry, but also women who were socialists. It has never achieved the same kind of level as other national holidays. I think socialism is alive and well today, but it takes a different form than it did in the early 20th century. So obviously there are far fewer people today who are card-carrying members of the Socialist Workers' Party. But I think that if we look at practice, if we look at what people are doing on the ground, if we look at what people are doing in their communities, the ways in which they're mobilizing, the kinds of demands they're putting on local governments, their ways of developing networks of support. People in the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, have been pushing for, you know, radical care movements, which is developing systems of support within the African American community. I see that almost as a prototype of a socialist society. How can we create systems of support for one another? How can we take care of one another when our government, as it currently exists, our neoliberal government, has failed us? I have done a lot of work in Mississippi, and I work with a group called the Mississippi Low Income Child Care Initiative, and that is a group of women on welfare and their advocates that lobbies the state of Mississippi for expanded welfare in the state. And I taught a course with them. I've worked with them for a few years now. And when I took my students down there, we traveled all over the state into the Delta, Jackson, to the coast. And we met with really amazing people all over the state of Mississippi, very few of whom I think would call themselves feminists, and very few of whom I think would call themselves socialists. But these were Black and white women who were struggling for political, social, and economic transformation in their day-to-day lives. And so to me, those are models of what I might call socialism, even if they don't call themselves socialists, because I think that those are microcosms of the kind of social transformation that I would like to see that's rooted in racial justice, in gender justice, and in economic justice.
Do you feel we need that ideology of socialism that we had in the past? Or do you feel like it's happening now in a different way that is appropriate for this time?
I think that we need to struggle on multiple levels. So I think that we do need to see this kind of grassroots community-based work that's happening. I also think that we need to think strategically about the role of what a new society would look like. And that is, how do we get from grassroots community-based organizations to a more fundamental social transformation? That is a conversation that has to happen. I think since the 1970s, really, we've seen such an assault on people on the left. I should say since the 1960s with COINTELPRO, with the ways in which the federal government literally you know, arrested people, murdered people, locked people up, shut them down, who identified as socialists. And this includes people in the Black Panther Party, people in SDS. It dates back further than that. I'm thinking the 60s, but no, it was the 50s. No, it was actually the 20s. So I guess the point I would make is there is a very, very long history in this country of trying to silence and undermine the left. And I think that assault on the left that dates back 100 years has done damage to people who openly identify as socialists. And I don't know if the term itself matters as much to me as the work itself. And I think the work has been happening and will continue to happen. But I do think we have to, at some point, pull back and think about how do we move to the next stage? How do we move from communities that are developing systems of and networks of support and care and fighting for economic justice on the local level? How do we move from that to something bigger and transformative on a national level?
Of domestic workers organizing outside of a union. We had Unite starting outside of a union. What do you think has happened to the unions that has made it so that the organizing is now coming from the grassroots and not from the unions?
I think the traditional union model in this country is one that is premised on the manufacturing and industrial sector. It is the vision that people have is, for example, the United Auto Workers, the sit-down strikes of the 1930s. That image plays a prominent role in how we understand labor unions and union organizing. So it's very male-defined in a lot of ways. I think it's also premised on a model of someone working for a company for their entire lives. So unions have organized in relation to corporations, in relation to companies that people work for. And the labor market has shifted drastically in the past 30 years. Most people today are not working for the same company their entire lives. They're shifting from job to job. They might not even be in the same occupation their whole lives. They might be working in multiple jobs at the same time. So I think part of the problem with the traditional labor movement is that it has not spoken to the ways in which the labor market has shifted. So I think why the domestic workers and the fast food workers, the Fight for 15 movement has been so effective is because it's not premised on a workplace organizing model. It is premised on pushing an agenda that will protect workers who earn below a certain wage or workers who are in a particular industry and fighting for rights for them. Most of the domestic worker models actually come out of worker centers. They're not specifically domestic worker rights organizations. They began as community-based organizations that organized day laborers as well as domestic workers and nail salon workers. And this meant that they were able to organize people where they were in their communities. And some of those people who are domestic workers might be a domestic worker one day and might be a home health care aide the next day, right? And so that I think the more innovative, the cutting edge labor movement that's disproportionately women of color today is one that is more nimble in that regard. And it's able to meet people where they are. I think the fact that it's outside of the current labor law is a benefit, right? We've talked about these as the excluded workers, but I think the fact that their labor organizing tactics have no oversight by the federal government, by the National Labor Relations Board, I think is a benefit. And it gives them a little bit more autonomy, a little bit more flexibility about how they can organize and what they can fight for.
So even though we don't have mass celebrations or marches like they had in the 20s around IWD, you're saying that the grassroots labor movement is proliferating and is alive and well.
Absolutely.
Impunity for my killer!
Hola, my name is Lulu Barrera, and I am a feminist activist based in Mexico City. And I work with luchadoras, that means women warriors, and we are a collective here in Mexico. International Women's Day last year in Mexico was a blast. It was fantastic. I think the last 2 or 3 years in Mexico, we've been seeing a growing and growing feminist movement that's also very much related to the use of social networks, to a generational renewal, let's say. And there's a lot of young women from high school even that are starting to recognize themselves as feminists. So they are taking over the streets, they are creating their own collectives, they are creating Instagram accounts, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts to spread the word. So last year, also because of the worsening of the scenario of violence against women in Mexico and feminicide, and a couple of declarations by the president, which were misinterpreting the reality of the heavy crisis of femicide we have in the country, there was a huge turnover of women on the streets last year for the 8th of March. And also there was a very wide open call to a stop on the 9th of March. And this paro really extended to many new dimensions and new institutions that we never ever seen before. The banks joined the paro, government institutions joined, and there was a heavy cost of loss of economic flow for that day registered last year. So that was a fantastic moment of outbreak of feminist movement. But then the pandemic came, and we had to go back to our homes. So we don't know how the things are going to be this year. Probably it won't be as exciting.
And you had about 80,000 people last year, is that right?
Yeah. Also, the march and the protest and the battle, they were nationwide. So we had more than 20 cities joining. So it was massive.
And just in Mexico City, there was tens of thousands of women marching.
Yeah, the protest was so big that many people, many women could not reach the Zócalo, the main square at the downtown, which was the final point for the protest to end, because the protest was so huge that many of them will just not get there of how many people were. But also we are facing a scenario that's worsening more and more, which is the deployment of security forces that are disproportionate in terms of the type of manifestations and protests we have. There's a huge number of security forces on the streets with some equipment that, yeah, make a very hostile environment around the protests, because some parts of the protests have became very, we call it in Mexico, acción directa, which is direct action. No, some women paint on monuments and leave messages asking for justice. And well, authorities seem to be very likely to defend monuments. And yeah, the security forces are disproportionate.
Violence against women in Mexico is getting worse, and it was already an epidemic. And I can only imagine under COVID, it's not getting any better. What has been the response of the government to that? And what are the factors that are perpetuating it in Mexico?
Yeah, the violence against women during pandemics has worsened. Calls of help to the 9/11 has increased very, very importantly. And the number of sexual abuse or rape hasn't diminished. Many women are forced to stay home with their aggressors, which could be a family member, the partner, And well, we have a very schizophrenic reaction from the government. From one side, we have the institutions like the Women's Institute trying to do some actions, some campaigns, some of them with no success, which has like a very, very heavy critics against. But also we have a president that continuously denies on public conference that violence against women in Mexico is a problem. So that, it's very tiring for a feminist activist to keep listening and listening that your president undermines what is affecting you directly.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you're hopeful because you see a lot of younger women becoming activated, especially about this issue, violence against women in Mexico, is that right?
Yeah, I think I've been a feminist activist over the last 15 years, let's say, and I've never seen this force as it is right now. I'm very, very hopeful. I'm sure this is a mix between the online and the offline. The Me Too movement, it has created a lot of organization, new collectives are emerging, more young people are taking over the streets, silence, historical silence is being broken. It's very hopeful times.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to KPFA Radio's special International Women's Day programming, and I am your host, Lisa Detmer. Stay tuned for some more women activists from around the world.
Que tiemble el Estado, los cielos, las calles, que teman los jueces y los judiciales. Hoy a las mujeres nos quitan la calma, nos sembraron miedo. Nos crecieron alas. A cada minuto de cada semana nos roban amigas, nos matan hermanas, destrozan sus cuerpos, los desaparecen. No olvides sus nombres, por favor, señor presidente. Por todas las compas marchando en Reforma, por todas las morras peleando en Sonora, por las comandantas luchando por Chiapas, por todas las madres buscando en Tijuana, cantamos sin miedo, pedimos justicia, gritamos por cada desaparecida, que resuene fuerte, nos queremos vivas, que caiga con fuerza el feminicida. Yo todo lo incendio, yo todo lo rompo. Si un día algún fulano te apaga los ojos, ya nada me calla, ya todo me sobra. Si tocan a una, respondemos todas.
I'm Karen Tanyaga. In the Philippines, the IWD is important. Maybe I just wanted to say that IWD is an opportunity. It's a place, a space where women gather together to continue fighting for our rights. Sometimes it's also a space of celebration, but it's where women can gather together. So actually in the past years, I've celebrated IWD in, because it's celebrated also in different towns and cities, no? So in Baguio, it's a place up north where we have women of the Cordillera, mainly of the northern tribes. One time also in a province in south of Luzon, Sorsogon. And another time in Agusan del Sur, where they had, it was a whole day of celebration where women of different tribes had their different dances. And there were also workshops about, you know, what they see as women's rights and what they can do to move forward. So it's a good day for getting together and strengthening ourselves for further struggle. The last time we were able to celebrate, which we did on March 6th instead of March 8th last year, there was a gathering in one park. And one of the things we did was, you know, do that dance of the rapist is you, following the Chile, you know, dance movements and the music. We draw our inspiration also internationally for our struggles.
And I see that President Duterte was one of the targets in 2020. As you said, that he is not a big supporter of women's rights. Is that right?
Not only that, but in a way he has chosen to target several high profile women leaders and politicians, particularly as part of his effort to strengthen, in a way, his authoritarian rule. It's a growing authoritarian rule. So, for example, our vice president, our former Supreme Court chief, whom he helped take down from her position, Senator Laila de Lima, Senator Risa Ontiveros. So these women who are really working for women's issues have become target of his efforts to take them down, especially with a lot of disinformation, using a troll army. So these are some of the things that have happened. Of course, we've also had so many extrajudicial killings. So one concern for some of our groups is also to help take care of women. They're not so many who are the direct targets of the killings, but usually they're the widows, the mothers, the sisters.
My name is Dr. Tlaleng Mofokeng, and I'm a medical doctor in Johannesburg and the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health. So we know that the celebration and commemoration of women's struggle in South Africa did culminate during the apartheid years in the massive mobilization of women from across the country to march to the union buildings in South Africa. And at the time, the common advocacy issue was to resist the requirement of the production of Donbasses by people who at the time, the majority of Black people in this country. And, you know, with the dawn of democracy, it was important to keep celebrating and remembering those moments. Hence, we mark on the 9th of August, National Women's Day. And I think in many ways, many of us who are activists in South Africa still draw our inspiration from the ability of those women to organize and to march and stand up for their rights in the way that they did.
And this was predated by the Women's Charter. The Federation of African Women was launched in 1954 as the first attempt to create a broad-based women's organization. Is that true?
It's important to talk about the different moments, you know, in our fight for democracy where women did play a big role. And the Women's Charter is one such event. I think, again, it's important, you know, when you're looking back, hindsight is 2020. And I can imagine how those women felt a little impatient at the time, you know, thinking and perhaps even wondering if any of their activism and activities are going to yield any results. But looking back, you know, we wouldn't be here as a country and as women in South Africa if it wasn't for those important, important moments of mobilizing, of forming, and on of really cementing ourselves as equal liberators for this country.
And then in 1995 was the first beginning of the current 1995 onward Women's Day March, the commemoration of the day. What is the importance of the Women's Day March or celebration today?
The Women's Day commemoration is still important in South Africa, as many of us who are young and old and middle-aged women, often we find a bit of desperation, right? Because we find that democracy in some ways did do a lot of work around racial justice, but there's still a lot to be said and done around the issues of gender justice and some of the oppression that women in South Africa continue to face, living in constant fear of violence and intimate partner violence, and then trying to reach out for help in a public health system that also, you know, doesn't affirm and that's often undignified in the way they treat survivors. It tells you the importance of why every single year many of us in very different ways still commemorate and in some way celebrate those women. It's important for us, even though we don't galvanize as many numbers on a yearly basis in terms of a commemoration march, but we do a lot of activities throughout the year, pulling directly from that tenacity and from the strength of those women in everything that we do, even though our struggle may be a little bit slightly different, but all of it was always for gender equality.
And you do a lot of work around reproductive health and sexual and reproductive health. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those issues in South Africa, or what issues you think are the important issues that women are facing.
So I'm a doctor who has turned an activist and a human rights defender. If you look at our constitution in South Africa, we are hailed, you know, all over the world as a country that has a really great constitution and policies, but we fail in how we implement those policies. Just an example, we have the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act of 1996, which legalizes safe abortion within health facilities. And yet, despite that act, we still have many people, you know, falling victim to people who are pill sellers on the streets because of the stigma, because of a lack of access to clinics that offer the service and the lack of trained healthcare professionals. And you then have the impact of a foreign policy like the global gag rule that gets enforced by USAID, you know, health funding and financing that further restrict access, advocacy and information on abortion. So the frustration for me as a South African, as a woman, as a doctor, is the fact that despite our constitution, we are failing to make sure that those human rights are realized and that they are operationalized in everyday public health systems and in the way that patients receive care.
And when you say it's failing, are you talking about the government's failure?
Absolutely. I'm talking about the government's failure to operationalize and to translate our constitution into literal accessible services that are not only safe, but also dignified and timeous. I'm also talking about, for example, we know the very high statistics of rape in this country, and that many people, not only is their first sexual experience possibly coercion or rape, that many of those survivors of that kind of violence do not have services that are nearby where they can go for post-rape support. And the South African Medical Research Council recently launched a research report, and I did the keynote address for them. And they were speaking about how many women in South Africa are actually seroconverting and getting HIV directly as a result of a rape and the inability of the public health system to provide them with post-rape support, which would include post-exposure prophylaxis for HIV, emergency contraception, and counseling and psychosocial support. So it's a direct failure of governance and the ability to protect human rights and to see the right to health as integral and very important.
Do you see that it is possible under capitalism and neoliberalism for women to have that kind of gender equality? Or do you think that it requires a move to either socialism or another form of production?
Sure. It's difficult because a lot of the discussions and the conversations around socialism are again being led by men, right? Which tells me that they are just going to transfer whatever power they have and just change the name of the system, but retain the power. And so for us, it will still feel like oppression, you know? So I want us to get to a point where women are leading and women are creating this future that we want. And one of the ways of doing that, it's to be defiant. And the ways that I'm defiant in my everyday life is to live that feminist vision and that feminist future right now and make the decisions I would make if I feared nothing. And that's how you kind of show others what feminism is, but also keep yourself inspired. Because at the end of the day, I'm not doing this work to save some woman in America. I'm doing this work to save myself literally every single day. Because even when I'm walking down the street, no one cares. No one knows that you are the UN Special Rapporteur, that you are a medical doctor. You are just a Black woman who everyone thinks has a right to harass and say and do whatever that they feel like to it. So we need to realize, you know, that none of those things are protections, and that in fact, it's us by being bold when we can, because there's a real cost, right, to standing up to patriarchy. There's a real violence that you attract by being hyper visible. But I think it's by being strategic and finding the people that do the same work you do, who can take turns. You know, when I'm tired and I need time out to rejuvenate and take time for self-care and mental care, it's important that I know that the work continues. Because I think most of us work ourselves into burnout because we are siloed. We are almost removed from each other and that support system. So it's about creating more of the support system, and whatever we call that system, when most of us are living that future, I'm happy for us to not even have a name for it. But what worries me about these discussions, and why we have even things like neocolonialism, it's that it's exactly the same oppression. It just looked different in the day, in this day and age, you know, because power still lies in exactly the same place. So for as long as these discussions are being had and being led by men and the visions of men, I think we were not gonna get where we need to get to faster. Yeah.
Next, I talked to another voice from South Africa, Preg's Governor, a feminist human rights activist, writer, and author of Love and Courage, a story of insubordination, and someone who is widely respected for her contribution to advancing women's rights in South Africa and internationally.
Let me start with International Women's Day. I think it's still an extremely important day of international solidarity. Today it was initiated by socialist women in solidarity with working women in factories, and during apartheid, for example. I worked as a trade union educator in the clothing and textile union. And so the resonance with what happened to, I think it was about 156 American women being killed in a factory, most of whom were young and migrant working women. There was a lot of resonance with that experience as women who were fighting against an apartheid and patriarchal and a capitalist system. The importance of international solidarity was critical for us. And I think it remains critical because today, while South Africa has officially in 1994 dismantled apartheid legislation, the structure of a racist, patriarchal, capitalist state remains largely intact because we entered and became part of a neoliberal global economy. We adopted in 1996 a macroeconomic framework that reinforced that. And I'd been asked to be the speaker in Parliament at the time on what was called GEAR, And after going through it, I remember thinking, this is terrible. It's going to be terrible for women who are poor and working class, the majority of whom are Black women in our country. And then I refused to speak, to say that it was going to be good for women, because it was not. At the time, I was chairing the Parliamentary Committee on Women, which was looking at these issues. And I think the fact that at that time, in 1996, South Africa adopted this neoliberal economic framework, it also began negotiating what has become quite infamous, which was the South African arms deal with Germany, Sweden, and Britain. Even today, Britain is supporting both sides in the Yemen war, for example, as long as you're making money, right? So I think the fact that today, during the pandemic, the United States, for example, has sanctioned increasing military budgets points to the priorities of our world. And the fact that across the world, the unemployment has risen, precarious employment has risen, and poverty and inequality have deepened, and violence has deepened. So the connections between militarizing society, militarizing the world, and increased violence is not a coincidence. Increased gender-based violence is not a coincidence. It's part of the same continuum. So I think International Women's Day at this point in time is a critical day to call us to that, to solidarity with each other.
I'm wondering if you could explain to people a little bit more the pressures or the reasons why the ANC accepted or was forced to accept a neoliberal program and how that affects women.
I think that in the Women's March of 1956, socialist women played a critical role in organizing, in the organizing work. But again, it was in alliance with women who were not socialist women. Not all the women who marched were socialist women. Or identified as socialist. So that's an important thing. So many of us grew up as socialist feminists in the struggle against apartheid. It's what informed our practice, and it's what informed the trajectory we took when we came into parliament in our new democracy. The pressures on the ANC alliance during the transition were from a neoliberal world order. So if you think about 1992 to 94, what was happening globally was a real pushback against socialism, a real ascendancy of neoliberalism. And so the people who were socialist in South Africa were suddenly being engaged very powerfully by vested interest groups within the country and outside the country. And so even though women, for example, were integrally involved in the struggle and in all the different movements. If you look at the trade union movement, women were fighting not just for better wages and working conditions, but also against sexual harassment, for maternity and parental rights, for safer working conditions, etc. So there was a lot of integration of the demands that working class and poor women were putting into the mix. So the power imbalances, I think, from both economic, political, and military were significant. And so even, I mean, I think if you think about international solidarity at the time, and you think about Mandela inviting Castro to come to our parliament and to speak at our parliament, that was met with a lot of opposition. So pushing against the tide is not easy. There's always this tension between who has power in the world and locally. So, and I think if you think about women's rights specifically in the economic terrain is critically linked to, so for example, if women are losing their jobs in a country in which we fought to change the labor laws to ensure that women had rights in the workplace, when you lose your job, you are immediately outside of all of those rights. And you are extremely vulnerable then in living in poor living conditions, in settlements that have no or little access to the basics, whether it's a house, to water, to electricity, to toilets. And all of that makes women who much more vulnerable to misogyny. And misogyny cuts across race, class, etc. But it really, religion, whatever, it cuts across. But the ability to act with impunity is strengthened when there are no streetlights. And you're coming back from working in the so-called informal sectors late at night, and you have to go to a toilet in the felt, you have to go and collect water, etc. So it's those conditions, those material conditions worsen women's vulnerability to misogyny and to gender-based violence there. If you have a neoliberal economy which increases unemployment, which increases precarious employment, it's increasing its jobs that are still maintaining poverty. It doesn't get people out of poverty. And so that context, that structural violence is deeply connected to gender-based violence. If you look in every single racial or ethnic group, misogyny exists across every one of them. But when these material conditions are material realities of no lighting, a door that can be kicked into your room, a toilet that can be pushed over, you have no chance. And that is what a neoliberal economy does to women's lives, has done in our country.
Sisters have died. Over 500 years has washed away our fears and strengthened our pride. Now we turn back the tide. We will no longer hear your commands. We will slide your control from our
That's it for my hour of special International Women's Day programming. I hope you have a better idea of what International Women's Day is all about now. So while you can't go out and march, you can celebrate with us here on KPFA Radio. I'm Lisa Detmer and I've been your host today, and I would like to thank the women who took the time to speak to me today, Eileen Boris, Premila Nadison, Karen Tanada, Craig's Governor, Dr. Mofe King, and Lulu V. Barrera. And lastly, I want to thank Margot Okozawa-Ray for connecting me with so many of these women. Keep tuned in for more International Women's Day programming right here on KPFA Radio.